backup diesel generators. Not too long after that, less than an hour later, a tsunami flooded the diesel generators and knocked all of them out, completely eliminating all power on the site. This led to a loss of all power except for some batteries for limited times. They were doing such haphazard things as taking scavenged car batteries, doing anything they could to try and keep these reactors under control, because what they knew and what the world saw within a 24-hour period was that once these reactors were no longer being cooled, even after they shut down, they're so very hot that the water began to boil off, hydrogen gas was formed, and explosions destroyed three of the reactors. The zirconium fuel rod cladding overheats, and as the zirconium breaks down within the presence of water and steam, it splits off hydrogen gas, which caused the explosions. So the melted fuel then sank down through the bottom of the reactors. In addition to concerns about the reactors themselves, there was a great deal of concern about the spent fuel pools. There's an even higher amount of radioactivity contained in these spent fuel pools than there are in the reactors themselves. They were very concerned that with a loss of coolant and perhaps with some damage at a couple of the different spent fuel pools, that they would be losing water there. And in fact, some initial indications were that they were losing water at reactor number 4 spent fuel pool. There was a hydrogen explosion at the spent fuel pool, or at reactor number 4, which they suspected, because the reactor had been closed down, they thought it must have been hydrogen gas that came off of that pool. Later, they determined that it was hydrogen gas that had moved from building number 3 into building number 4 and caused that explosion. But for a couple of weeks, they didn't really know what had caused that explosion at reactor number 4. We were lucky. You know, if that spent fuel pool at reactor number 4 had broken down and the radioactive material there had been released, it would have been many times the amount of radioactivity that would have been released in Chernobyl. But the reactor accident would have been many times worse than it ended up being. The outcome was 3 reactor core meltdowns, 2 endangered spent fuel pools, 3 hydrogen explosions that ruptured reactor buildings, 3 overpressurized and leaking containments, massive releases of radiation into the air and water, and ongoing environmental hazard at and around the site. The greatest immediate concern was the release of iodine-131 and cesium-137. Radioactive iodine can concentrate in people's thyroid glands. In fact, around nuclear power plants, people are supposed to have a supply of iodine tablets to take in the event of an accident to prevent the uptake of radioactive iodine in their thyroids. These tablets were never issued in the Fukushima area except at one of the hospitals to their own personnel. Both of these were released in sufficient quantity that was even measurably found in the Pacific Northwest and throughout the United States. There were hot spots of iodine and cesium that were measurable, not enormously beyond the amount that you would find in naturally occurring, except in a few cases, and subsiding fairly rapidly, but nonetheless, the fact that worldwide you could see the result of this is fairly dramatic. The Japanese are extremely lucky that the bulk of their fallout went out over the Pacific Ocean and not over the mainland of Japan. The United States was treating this accident very seriously from day one. They actually thought that there was a spent fuel incident going on. They thought that Reactor 4 was going to lose its spent fuel pool, or they suspected it might. They were telling people that people as far away as Tokyo should begin to consider evacuating. Union of Concerned Scientists, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the other groups that I work with believe that about 10 to 20% of the amount of radioactivity that was released at Chernobyl was released in this accident, which is still an awful lot of radioactivity, particularly for people at the local level. They were evacuating people from within 20 kilometers and moving them into red areas of high radiation, which were supposedly safer, but of course they weren't. Because they were so disorganized, their efforts to try to deal with this catastrophe were so hampered by the tsunami itself, which created utter chaos. 20,000 people were killed in that tsunami. There's a tremendous amount of damage. So it was extremely chaotic conditions. And they were having people evacuate into areas that were highly contaminated until they got around to measuring it. They said, oh no, well, you know, then they moved them further out eventually. There continue to be aquatic releases. This is one of the methods they use to cool reactors. These reactors were melting down. The water was boiling away. They were having to jerry-rig all sorts of ways to get water to them, because even though they were melted down, they were not out. They still are not out. They are hot as can be. At this point, they're still pumping 400 tons of water onto the reactors on a daily basis in order to try and keep them cool. And they'll have to do this for another 10 years at least. We now have achieved cold shutdown, but as I said, water must be constantly circulated through the damaged reactors and spent fuel pools and then stored, and the site radiation dose is increasing. Some radioactive water is being recycled and reused, but a lot of it is leaking into the sea at this point. Decommissioning may take decades and cost $20 billion or more. I think that's a low estimate. The human toll. Compensation and remediation of contaminated areas may cost $125 billion, and over 130,000 people are still displaced. Cancer deaths may number in the thousands, but most will be the result of radiation exposures not yet received, because people are still living in semi-contaminated areas, and the government is trying to get them to move back into some of the areas that they've previously been evacuated from. There's been an extreme amount of effort taken by the government to hire low-wage workers, a lot of them employed by criminal gangs, because it's very hard to find workers who are willing to work at this site. They're going about and scraping up the soil, scooping it into plastic bags, and then in that way taking some of the surface contamination away and making an area safe. The trouble is, every time it rains and the wind blows off the trees, all of the additional cesium and strontium comes down from the mountains and recontaminates those areas. And then where do you put these plastic bags of contaminated soil? So going forward, evacuees are being encouraged to return to some of the zones, being prepared a safe dose to the public was changed from 1 millisievert to 20 millisieverts per year, which is about what used to be the worker dose that was allowed, but they're allowing that dose for all civilians. That's also, by the way, what the US EPA is recommending be adopted for the United States in the case of an accident of this type, which would increase the chance of getting a cancer to be 1 in 6 among people who are exposed on an annual basis to that much radiation. In the surrounding townships, not that many people really want to come back. The towns that are immediately around Fukushima, only 17.6% of Nami, 12.3% of Futaba, 13.3% of Okuma, and 11.9% of Tomioka want to return home. But they may not be given a choice. The government has not said that they're not going to compensate people to relocate them, but so far they have not tried to force people to go back. But the conditions they're living in under currently is temporary housing and not terribly pleasant situation. They're sort of in limbo. TEPCO is pumping about 800 tons a day of radioactive water out of the reactor buildings to desalinate and filter radioactive cesium, and it's pouring about 400 tons a day back into the reactors to keep them cool, some of which leaks back out of the buildings. The other half is stored in a growing tank farm. They add each day a new tank. U.S. experts that we've sent from the U.S. Department of Energy are now recommending that they dump water from these tanks. They say it's not an ideal situation, but it isn't that much radiation, they claim, although the local fishermen are against it. The fishermen were promised that this would not happen. The Japanese government hasn't agreed to do this yet because they're afraid of a public outcry over it. Now, concerns going forward regarding Fukushima locally, for the people that I talk with, initially, there was some hot spots for radioactive iodine and cesium that were monitored by the U.S. government in Oregon and Washington. It receded within a month back to background level. Salmon are being tested on an annual basis in the Columbia River by the Washington Department of Ecology, and they haven't found any increase, they claim. Measurable cesium from Fukushima has now reached the Pacific coast, according to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. They are using volunteers. They haven't gotten any federal money to actually study this. Volunteers collect seawater in different places. local monitoring is not as extensive as it should be. Testing should be more transparent, more actual figures listed on the government websites rather than below concern so that people can know exactly what they're finding. I personally believe that wild mushrooms should be tested and be included because they concentrate cesium, have been proven to be the source of radioactivity in wild boar in Germany, that it's still too hot to be allowed for public consumption from the Chernobyl fallout. So if we're going to look at one species in the Northwest, it would seem to me that forest mushrooms would be an interesting one to study and take a look at and see if there's noticeable amounts of cesium in it. But nobody's doing that. Interested citizens who do want to collaborate with their own monitoring should work with groups like RADCAST. So, could it happen here? According to a lot of people who looked at this, things aren't that different in the United States than they were in Japan when this accident occurred. In fact, the Japanese bought a GE reactor built by GE, and they modeled their nuclear power program on what we have been doing in the United States. Our nuclear plants are vulnerable to catastrophic natural disasters, terrorist attacks, multiple system failures, and our emergency plans are inadequate, mainly because our administration, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency feels that these types of accidents are so unlikely that they don't do extensive planning to deal with them, which is exactly what happened with the Japanese. As Ed said, yes, it can happen here because of complacency. I'll give you some examples here in a moment. We have one nuclear power plant in the Pacific Northwest, and there's two in Diablo Canyon down near San Luis Obispo in California. Those are the only three nuclear reactors on the West Coast. What they're talking about doing in case something like this happens, where you have a station blackout and you have to get power and water to a site right away, they formed a near-term task force to look at what went wrong at Fukushima. Their recommendations are that we have a regulatory framework that takes these types of accidents into account more than previously we have, that reevaluates seismic and flooding hazards, strengthens station blackout capability, requires reliable hardened vents. Unfortunately, our reactor here in the Northwest, the Columbia Generating Station, is a boiling water reactor of that type, and they are requiring them now to put a vent into it, although they won't have to do that until 2017. So the conclusion from Union Concerned Scientists, which by the way is not an anti-nuclear organization, as they hasten to say, is that Fukushima can happen here. Fukushima was not a Japanese nuclear accident. It was a nuclear accident that happened to occur in Japan. The nuclear industry regulators, politicians must abandon the it can't happen here mindset and apply all the lessons of Fukushima to nuclear power plants here at home. Otherwise, nuclear power's credibility may not survive another serious accident or terrorist attack. One would hope. I would think it would have a hard time surviving this last one, from my point of view. To move to the specifics with the Columbia Generating Station, our own reactor, and why we think it should be closed, it is a GE boiling water reactor. The first round had Mark I containments. They're very small, narrow containment. A boiling water reactor. They have cooling ponds, most of them. Some of them dump their hot water back into the ocean or whatever they're in. But in the case of the Columbia Generating Station, it has very dramatic plumes of steam. And a tremendous amount of Columbia River water has run through it, actually. Columbia reactor combines the worst flaw of the Mark I and also has the flaw in the Mark II. It's similar in size to the Mark I. It's the smallest of the Mark II reactors. And part of the problem with the containment at Fukushima was that because it was so small, the hydrogen gas actually forced its way out. It created so much pressure that it forced its way out of the containment and got into the reactor building and caused an explosion there, cooled inside there, and a spark caused an explosion there. These small containments were known by the GE designers to be a problem. In fact, a group of three of them had a very well-publicized protest, went to the press, said these are not safe reactors in the 1970s. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission ignored them. And now we finally saw the result at Fukushima of what happens when you build your containment structures too small. The other problem is that it's cooling water. There's a suppression pool underneath it. One of the ways you're supposed to scrub the radioactive materials out when you do vent, it gets pushed into the water underneath, and it scrubs out radioactive materials before it gets vented. In a meltdown, they now realize that that was bad design, because in a meltdown, it'll melt right through and destroy that suppression capacity completely. That wasn't true in the Mark I's, but it is true in the Mark II's. So we got the worst of both worlds. Another interesting thing that Ed discovered about the select plan, where they're talking about moving all this equipment from Phoenix up to the Columbia Generating Station, if they had to do that, if they had a station blackout. One of the things they're supposed to look at is if Grand Coulee Dam is knocked out. For some reason, they're only looking at whether or not half of Grand Coulee Dam is knocked out. I think that's because if only half of Grand Coulee Dam is knocked out, then the reactor survives. But if all of it were knocked out, the reactor would be underwater. But in any case, if half of it were knocked out, that would still create a lot of chaos. It would flood Richland with 60 feet of water. It would wipe out all the roads, knock out all the power lines, and create a station blackout situation. In that case, also, the airport would be completely inundated. Bringing in equipment from Phoenix would be extremely difficult. You'd have to bring it somewhere else and then drive it somehow there. So they went to the NRC, Energy Northwest, which runs this reactor, has renamed itself to Energy Northwest, wisely. They went to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and said, well, you know, what are we going to do about this? And they said, oh, well, don't worry about that. Just do your flex plan. You haven't finished your study on the dam burst, so do your flex plan. The dam burst is not in your original license, so you don't have to consider that when you're doing your flex plan. You can deal with that issue later. You know, this is classic NRC thinking. This is unfortunately how their minds operate. So the Columbia Generating Station is the only nuclear plant in the Northwest. So it generated power for 31 years, but supplies only 3.9% of the region's needs. Dirty, dangerous, and expensive, which is actually a slogan that was begun by the Sierra Club. It's not as carbon-free as advertised, but it uses more, you know, more than double the amount of solar photovoltaic. So Columbia Generating Station design has some striking similarities to Fukushima. It is a GE reactor. It's quite identifiable. Now, we began looking, first off, the most likely way that this reactor could have a problem would be if there were an earthquake. And there have been some big ones. 1872, there was a magnitude 7.4. There are now 11 additional earthquake faults that they know about. When they were first starting to build these plants, actually, it's interesting, Allison McFarlane, who is a geologist and was the chair of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission until recently, points out that when they first started building nuclear power plants in the early 70s, plate tectonics was still a theory. So geology's come a long way since they started building these nuclear plants. Another real obvious thing that could happen, I'm not saying it would necessarily happen at Columbia, but nonetheless, it could be a terrorist target, and at one point there was a news report that it was considered as a terrorist target. I don't know how valid that is, but it was reported. And it's certainly, they're all vulnerable. What we prefer in terms of spent fuel, as soon as it's cool enough to move out of the spent fuel pool, we favor storing it in dry casks, and they're air-cooled and self-contained. And the ones that they had in Japan survived the tsunami and did not crack or have problems. It's as good a solution as you're going to get, and even better would be to build some sort of building to contain all of it so that it would harden it even further. That's what the hardened on-site storage that we favor is about. Well, you build a building around it so that's the hardened part of it, that it's protected. Of course, this waste is, particularly this spent fuel waste, is going to have to be kept out of the environment, some of it for hundreds of thousands of years. At this point, we don't have a permanent disposal site established. In the ballot measure we passed in 1980 in Oregon said that the voters could decide to build more nuclear plants in Oregon once the federal government had established a waste disposal site. So then at that point, the voters could positively vote for it. But that has not happened, and we're not even close. People in Nevada rebelled against the idea of taking it at Yucca Mountain, and there were reasons why that was an incorrect site as well, because there's a lot of water migration through it. It was only about 50 miles north of Las Vegas. It's a volcanic area, and it's a seismically active area. So probably from what people have said, scientists have said, Arjun Makajani believes this, who's one of our friends who's a nuclear physicist in the D.C. area, hardened granite sites deep in the ground is probably the best place to store it. Finland is actually building one of those, as is Sweden. But those are the only two countries in the world that are actually doing that currently. Everyone else is allowing it to pile up, and no one's taking responsibility for it. Some countries believe that they can recycle that waste. France is notable, Japan, Great Britain. Unfortunately, what you end up with is the tank waste that we have at Hanford. That's the byproduct of recycling, because you reprocess the spent fuel, you take the plutonium out of it, and then you can use that. In our case, we were stockpiling it for bombs, or you can use it in reactors as fuel along with your uranium. But you did not make the waste go away. You still have a lot of really difficult waste to deal with. And you have mounds and mounds and piles of low-level waste is being dumped in at Hanford and in a number of other places around the country. Of less concern than the high-level waste, but not of zero concern. And they're being stored in much less rigorous conditions. They are leaking and will continue to leak. Capital expenditures needed to maintain the Columbia Generating Station. They're going to have to put these vents in. We don't know what the seismic upgrades are going to cost. And now this plant's been running for 30 years. They want to run it for another 30, and they're going to have to continue to replace parts. One of the most expensive is this turbine. They're going to have to replace all their turbines. That's going to cost about $150 million, they say. This was all discussed off budget. We got a copy of it. A mole gave us a copy of this information. And they were told by Bonneville not to talk about the $150 million in turbine replacement and put that in the 11th year, so it wouldn't be in the budget, so that people wouldn't know that it was coming. But they're supposed to plan 10 years in advance, and so they said keep it in the 11th year until you actually have to do it, and then we'll announce it. So this seems fairly obvious, but if we had a meltdown on the Columbia River, it would be very bad. It would not be good for the fish swimming in the Columbia River. Even if it were a relatively well-contained accident, it would economically taint our region. People wouldn't want to buy produce from our region. They wouldn't want to eat fish from our region. We would be the next Fukushima, essentially. There are 300,000 people living in the area surrounding Columbia Generating Station. Ironically, Battelle Northwest Labs and the Areva Nuclear Fuel Fabrication Plants would be two of the major victims of a meltdown there. Battelle Northwest Labs does a lot of nuclear research, although they're branching out into other areas. But they're a $1 billion enterprise, and they're located right on the border of Hanford and would have to be evacuated.
We are listening to excerpts from Chuck Johnson's talk about the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster 4 years ago. Mr. Johnson is director of the Joint Task Force on Nuclear Power for Oregon and Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility. The Mary's Peak chapter of the Sierra Club sponsored the talk in Corvallis along with the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I, Roberta Hall, recorded and edited it for this program for KABU.
Now I'm going to be accused of selling hopium by Mark Rabinowitz by talking about how renewable energy can replace carbon fuel, particularly in the Northwest, because we're getting so little energy from the Columbia Generating Station. We can replace that power with energy conservation and safer, cleaner energy like wind and solar. And that's happening. Load growth is actually leveled out and is declining in the Northwest currently. It's not going to be hard to replace that plant. It will be harder to replace the coal plants that we still haven't shut down yet. That's another topic. But replacing the nuclear plant, replacing that 4% will be easier than replacing the 30% of coal. Solar is really taking off in California right now, and figuring out how to feed all that in ways that make the grids work is difficult. But both of these are happening at a fairly high rate right now, not as fast as happened in Germany and some other places. New nuclear plants, I'm going to get to that. I've just been talking about how bad the old ones are, but perhaps there's some new design that solved these problems. Want to hear about small modular reactors? In Washington State, they're taking this very seriously. In addition to the Corvallis area where people are working at NuScale and working on this design, because of Hanford and because of all of the people working in the nuclear industry in Washington State, they are hoping that they can be the site of the first new small modular reactor. They were sort of passed over in the initial plan NuScale unveiled. Idaho is going to get the first of these small modular reactors. I don't think the Tri-Cities has fully accepted that yet. I think they're still fighting for it. They're in the process of passing in the Senate a whole slew of laws. Republicans control the Senate in the state legislature in Washington, and they're passing a bunch of laws that will allow them to count it as renewable energy, count new nuclear power plants as renewable energy as part of their requirements for the renewable portfolio standard. It's probably not going to pass. The word is it's not going to pass the House, and the governor is now indicating that he isn't supporting it. The nuclear renaissance, there have been actually several nuclear renaissances over the years, but the most recent nuclear renaissance started during the Bush administration. And there was a very influential 2003 MIT study that looked at the issues of costs, safety, waste, and proliferation. They said these are the four problems that need to be solved with a nuclear power plant now. If we're going to build more nuclear power plants, we've got to deal with these four problems. So a bunch of design concepts have been bandied around. Some of them are based on old ones that came from the 50s. High temperature gas-cooled reactors, sodium-cooled waste-burning reactors, thorium reactors. There are enthusiasts on the various websites who talk about thorium as being a better fuel to use. And then the improved design light water reactors. Because the nuclear industry is already used to building light water reactors, they got the fast track. In terms of the federal money for research, already Westinghouse was in the process of completing work on AP1000 reactor design, and Areva in France is creating their own new reactor, the Gen 3 EPR. And so those were the initial ones that people were looking at and saying, okay, they've designed a better light water reactor with some inherent safety features where you don't have to rely on pumps to get cooling water in. You have stored water and gravity is used during an accident. You don't have to pump water and constantly maintain electricity at the site. It's the theory anyway that it would make it safer. Unfortunately, as they've actually started building these things, once again, they run into cost problems. It's taking them a long time, just as in the first go-round with nuclear power. What really killed nuclear power wasn't a bunch of anti-nuclear activists like me, you know, running around. What killed it was the fact that it cost too much money, and the rates were going up so much that people started conserving energy, and it created a really bad cycle for these utilities where they weren't getting their money back. So they ended up only finishing about half the ones that they had originally planned to build. We're seeing a similar pattern again with these new reactors. Cost overruns. The ones in Georgia and South Carolina were supposed to be done right about now, actually, and it's looking like it'll be another 4 or 5 years at this point before they'll be finished. In those states, the Public Utility Commission, they're privately owned utilities that are building these, and they're allowing them to take the money directly from the ratepayers rather than borrow the money from someone else. And when you have that construction work in progress charge, you're allowed a rate of return on top of that. So in a sense, it's a negative incentive where the more you spend, the more you make. This was one of the things that was attractive about nuclear power in the 70s to utilities. Hey, if these things cost a fortune, we can just build more. But they didn't take into account that people might use less electricity. Again, this is happening in Georgia, South Carolina. In Florida, they spent $1 billion just on site preparation on a plant that they decided not to finish. And now they're billing the ratepayers for it because they're allowed to do that. There's a giant rate case going on that right now. The same problems that we've had before are happening again with these reactor proposals. So Guy and Corvallis and actually a number of different people around the world in various places have theorized that maybe if you could make these reactors in factories, you know, factory build them. You could build them in modules that you could add as you needed. It would cost less money. You put the basic plant in place and then you begin to add modules as you need them. And because they're factory built, they're cheaper. I'm not really sure how this works economically because no one has done it yet, but that is sort of the theory. If someone's from NuScale here can explain that differently, I'd love to hear it. But in any case, the smaller size does have advantages in terms of safety because they don't hold as much heat. The amount of time you need to cool them before they melt through whatever you're containing them in is less. So that is one design advantage. In the case of NuScale, they have some others and we'll talk about those in a minute. Just for fun, I did a little case study comparison of NuScale versus the Columbia Generating Station. Okay, NuScale would suspend 45 megawatt reactors up to 12 in a large underground tank with passive cooling systems self-contained in each reactor. The Columbia reactor has an active cooling system and backup spray ponds above ground that are vulnerable to a loss of coolant accident, similar in design to those meltdown in Japan. Advantage NuScale. Okay, NuScale would store extremely hot spent nuclear fuel submerged in water below ground. Columbia stores its extremely hot spent nuclear fuel in a pool 6 stories above ground, vulnerable to a massive release of radioactive material if the pool was breached and the water drained away. Advantage NuScale. NuScale claims that a standard model will be rated for up to 0.5 G ground motion in an earthquake. Columbia reactor was licensed in 1984 with design basis to withstand up to 0.25 G ground motion. U.S. Geological Survey scientists have revised estimates for Hanford up to 0.6 G ground motion. Advantage NuScale. So where do we sign up for NuScale? One little problem is that this design has not been completed. Last year, there was a lot of excitement about the fact that the federal government has put up to $217 million in matching funds to NuScale and the Fluor Corporation that bought NuScale, which is a large engineering firm based in Texas, to finish the design work, just the design work on this reactor. And they immediately announced that they were going to delay submitting their design to the NRC another year. Their earliest operating prototype, which is supposed to be in Idaho, is not until 2023. But anyway, all the other small modular reactors have been canceled at this point. Even one that got federal matching money. Babcock and Wilcox got federal matching money. They were the first ones. And they were going to build a small modular reactor in Clinch River, Tennessee. They couldn't find other backers, and they're not as willing as Fluor Corporation appears to be to just keep funding it alone. They wanted to find other financial backers to help them finish the design work on that reactor, so they've canceled. And all the others that didn't get federal money, including Westinghouse, which had a very serious plan that they were going to go forward with in Missouri, have canceled, said there isn't a market for it. We're just going to have to wait and see if a market appears and then respond to it later. The low cost of natural gas due to fracking and low cost of operating wind generators is making existing large baseload plants unprofitable. The cost of solar and wind continue to decline rapidly and can be delivered now. Storage options are becoming competitive, making variable systems more attractive. And SMRs don't have the economy of scale advantage of building a large nuclear plant to recoup the expensive construction with increased energy produced. That's why they were built large to begin with. They need orders and they need a supply chain. Factory production and modular design is supposed to reduce per unit cost. Westinghouse CEO said that you need to build about 30 to 50 of them or you're not going to make your money back. So you have to have a lot of orders and you have to have a very expensive supply chain at the ready in order to supply those orders. Foreign markets are possible, but again, we talked about those four issues of safety, cost, waste, and proliferation. This is potentially a proliferation problem. If you can buy your initial starter reactor for less money, it might be more attractive to groups and countries that want to have some sort of a nuclear reactor that could generate fissionable materials that they could use later. Okay, so costs, not currently favorable. Long-term prospects are dim. They do have Fluor, who seems to be willing to continue to fund them currently. Safety, possibly improved, but not yet proven or accepted by regulatory agencies for another decade at least. They still have to submit their design, and people are going to need to look at it and figure out whether it improves the safety. Waste, it produces the same type of long-lived radioactive waste. It's a light water reactor, so there's no improvement in that area. Proliferation, I talked about earlier. So I always try to end with a little quote from the founder of the nuclear navy, Admiral Hyman Rickover, who was the man who helped run the nuclear navy program that was successful in building the reactor for the Nautilus and all of aircraft carriers and submarines and everything else that run on nuclear power. And his famous quote, which he originally wrote in 53, but then he read into the record of the Atomic Energy Commission congressional hearings in 1970, he said, "An academic reactor or reactor plant almost always has the following basic characteristics. 1, it is simple. 2, it is small. 3, it is cheap. 4, it is light. 5, it can be built very quickly. 6, it's very flexible in purpose. 7, very little development will be required. It will use off-the-shelf components. 8, the reactor is in the study phase. It is not being built now. On the other hand, a practical reactor can be distinguished by the following characteristics. 1, it is being built now. 2, it is behind schedule. 3, it requires an immense amount of development on apparently trivial items. 4, it is very expensive. 5, it takes a long time to build because of its engineering development problems. 6, it is large. 7, it is heavy. 8, it is complicated. Unfortunately for those who must make far-reaching decisions without the benefit of an intimate knowledge of reactor technology, it is much easier to get the academic side of an issue than the practical side. For a large part of those involved with academic reactors have more inclination and time to present their ideas and reports and orally to those who will listen. Those involved with practical reactors, humbled by their experiences, speak less and worry more. And I just would add finally that Admiral Rickover was sort of on the fence about commercial nuclear reactors initially. That's why he was kind of warning them about the dangers of developing them. But after Three Mile Island, he came out in opposition to commercial nuclear energy because, in his opinion, if you try to mix commercialism to something as dangerous and difficult as building a nuclear reactor, you were going to likely have accidents. He did not trust it. And he also regretted the fact that, as he put it, it took us billions of years to get to the level of radioactivity that we have that allows life on this planet. And he regrets his part in having gone in a reverse direction on something that is as basic as that. You know, all the atmospheric nuclear testing that's taken place, we talk about background radiation, it includes that now. It's something we've added. We've added Chernobyl, we've added Fukushima, and all the waste that we're generating at all these nuclear power plants, we're adding to that burden that the Earth then has to absorb and deal with. Thank you.
And that was Charles Johnson of Physicians for Social Responsibility speaking on the 4-year anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. His talk in Corvallis was sponsored by Mary's Peak Sierra Club chapter. This program was produced by Roberta Hall. Do stay tuned now. Coming up next on KBOO Portland is Health Watch. Today's topic is culture wars, how the food giants turned yogurt into junk food. And then at 11:30, stay tuned on the radio zine, The Scholar Circle looks at deception and lying with a panel of scholars discussing whether lying is useful and possibly even biological. What is the truth about lying? And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today. And it is 11 a.m. It's almost 11:01. But don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.